You're listening to Two Sides of FI, a podcast that follows two lifelong friends as they seek financial independence and to retire early. I'm Eric, and I'm joined by my friend Jason, who reached FI in 2020. And this is our story.
You know, something I've been thinking about a lot is this idea of many people, once they achieve financial independence, i.e. once they have theoretically accumulated enough assets that will kind of carry them throughout the rest of their lifespan without needing to earn more money, they still find themselves desirous of earning more money or have reasons why they think they should be earning more money. And I thought that would be a really cool topic because on the surface, it sounds like this, I don't know, something that could be greedy or just come across as like, well, if you have enough, what are we talking about? Maybe one of the reasons people earn money in retirement is it's more just a product of something they're enjoying. And so for me, I love taking one day a week, you know, 7 hours usually, maybe 8 hours, teaching people about wine, talking to them, hopefully selling them some wine that kind of keeps the small business going that I do not own, right? And I get paid something as a result of that. It's not a lot of money, but it's kind of free money that I could use to do kind of fun things on my own. It's not out of the in the budget, but I don't do it as a means to pay my bills.
But was there ever a time, though, when you thought – it's kind of nice, or is it just it's nice to have this as not only spending money, but like it gives me a buffer to my buffer.
Yeah, it's you know, it's I think a lot of people would say the latter, because when they're doing these kinds of things, they're plugging that money into their budget. But what Lori and I decided early on is we both took one of these kind of 6 to 8 hour once a week things on, is that's just free money. It's outside our budget. It's just, you know, so I guess you could say it's a buffer on the kind of discretionary money we have in our budget, which is a pretty small amount that we each get that we don't have to talk about at all. And so it's kind of fun, but I've also gone long periods of time, you know, 6 weeks or more where I didn't earn this money and nothing really changed.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, it's enjoyable, but if I stop doing it tomorrow because we suddenly start traveling for months at a time, it's not going to change anything.
Yeah. I mean, and that is, I think, probably top of the list is like it could be a passion project that maybe you didn't have time for while you were employed and you want to explore more of that. Or, you know, in your case, I think in some ways you were exploring kind of the brewing industry and you know, you were in that adjacent kind of, you know, fermentation science area, right? You, like, because that was something that you were considering starting a business up in. And for you, it was kind of a way to dip your toe into that and see, okay, is this something I'm really interested in? Or are there just certain aspects of this? And I know the social component for you was pretty big. And as Laura and I get nearer to retiring early, the social component is like looming really large for me. So I can see something like this filling that need rather than like any kind of money. Because if I think about, you know, what the business could generate and walking away from the business, like I'd be kind of dumb to trade that for something where I'm earning essentially, you know, $15 an hour or 60. I don't know what you make at this winery, or if you're even willing to share
it's
that.
It's under $20 an hour.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, typically these roles make $15 to $20 an hour in the town I live in, depending upon the amount of training you have, how much retail experience you have, as well as knowledge of wine.
Yeah. But some people also use this as, you know, like Barista Fire is a real thing, right?
That's right.
You get to a point and you're like, okay, I just have to continue and meet expenses and I can take my foot off the gas and just coast a little bit because I'm working a high stress job. I want to step out of this and that makes for a better life overall. So in that case, it's more about earning your time back and earning, you know, some of your life back. And I see that as having a high, really high value.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, someone has reached financial independence, but they're choosing to do some other pursuit, like the classic barista job, where the term gets its name from, you know, for other benefits such as health insurance, right? Mm-hmm. They've already achieved the finances they need to make things work, but there's benefit to having some kind of work. And in theory, it should be a maybe less stressful, more enjoyable, maybe more flexible type of undertaking. So kind of still fits under that idea of fun. And I did like the way you put it. I hadn't thought of it in quite this way, which is, you know, a fun job could be just something you were interested in but never really had the time or able to take sufficient time to do. And, you know, that could be, you know, something that just turns a little bit of money because, you know, you're making something. And then, well, you're not just going to accumulate widgets in your house. Maybe you can sell them at a, on Etsy or a farmer's market or something. But you enjoy the making of that thing, craft or whatever it is. And it just becomes a little bit of fun money. And I think that's pretty common and makes a lot of sense.
I have a friend who he's a pretty talented architectural illustrator. And whenever he travels, he's always drawing the cities and the urban landscapes that he's in. And he's turned that into an Etsy business, which turns quite a bit of money.
Oh, wow.
So he's just taking, you know, kind of a passion project and he's turned it into something which is fulfilling, you know, but also pays back into the family's coffers a little bit. I don't think it's a life-changing amount of sum of money, but that must feel good to turn kind of the byproducts of a hobby you were going to do something you were going to do anyway into something that can, you know, help add to the buffer a little bit. I do think it's always this question of, you know, your time and how you value your time and what you're getting out of it in return. And it's kind of, that's kind of a gray area for me. You know, have you thought about that? Like how you value your time now that you're fully retired?
I have. And I think the answer also is going to change over time because right now, you know, we've got a teenager finishing high school. And so we have the schedule constraints you and I have talked about and that we share, right, due to having somebody still in school. But when the floodgates open, if you will, when we're able to do kind of whatever we want, well, I think Laurie and I are pretty open about the fact that these kinds of things aren't necessarily going to work.
Yeah.
Because I can't just show up to work for 4 or 5 weeks and just disappear for 90 days and then come back again. You know, they're going to fill that job and that's okay. And I think you kind of got to think about that because you're right. You are trading away time. And if we start plotting all that out, those hours and days, it's like, well, that could be interrupting otherwise uninterrupted time to do something else.
So how do you put a value on it?
Right now, I think about it pretty minimally. It's part of a day once a week. And it doesn't really disrupt much. And but
like,
is
there like an hourly figure? I guess that's I didn't ask question with enough specificity.
I don't think I'm quite so quantitative about it.
Okay,
I'm not. Now that's going to come up, and maybe now's the time to talk about it because there's been some things that I'm interested in, and that could potentially make money. But when I actually go back and retrospectively, I didn't do this prospectively, think about the amount of time I took learning a thing or learning about a thing that might make money and the money it made, that's silly. But I could say that I just enjoyed getting the knowledge, which is true, but maybe I'll be better about prospectively thinking about that in the future. I don't know. I love having the freedom to just waste my time learning about something only to put it down a month later. I mean, I know what you're laughing about. What are you going to ask me?
Well, I'm going to ask you, because, I mean, you sent me this post by Ern, Karsten Jessica, and the great blog, love his blog. But some of his posts, sometimes they get really deep. And so he did this post recently, back in March, on options trading, his option strategy and, you know, how he did in 2023. And, you know, if you do the effective hourly wage calculation based on what he says, you know, the amount of time that it took him to run this option strategy, which he netted something like $80,000 in 2023 from, you know, his average hourly rate, as I compute it, comes out to be like over $1,900 an hour.
Right.
And of course it takes, there's a lot of intellectual capital that you have to invest to get there and a fair bit of risk probably. And he's levered options and everything. Right. I mean, I know you read the post more than I did certainly, but, how is that not appealing? I mean, that's a great hourly wage.
Options. So first of all, options is appealing from an intellectual standpoint. It's something I knew next to nothing about. I knew what a call was. I knew what a put was. And that's kind of where it stopped. If we go back 3 years before now, I never used them as a means to make income. Right. It was a pretty boring investor. But once I was retired, started learning. I did not go deep on Ern's option post, and he has quite a few of them because I already could tell his strategy was something more than what I was ready for.
Next level.
So I read a couple of books, you know, followed a couple of YouTubers, learned some stuff, and did some pretty basic strategies last year. Running the wheel is a pretty common one. I'm not going to dig into it here, but I'm sure some of the people watching this know exactly what it is. But at the end of the day, they were pretty basic trades. I was collecting premium by selling cash secured puts, and maybe having to, you know, be assigned and then deal with covered calls. But anyhow, you know, I spent I don't even know how many hours. And I did enjoy it, reading those books, learning new terminology. And, you know, if you look at the sum of my trades, and I didn't do like scores of trades, but maybe I did like seven to nine different contracts. My total return, my absolute money earned is around $700.
Okay. So what's the hourly? It's like less than minimum wage for you there?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I didn't do anything risky. I'm not doing like, you know, crazy spreads or iron condors or any of these kind of like really cool named things. This is the most boring strategy possible. And it's so de-risked in terms of the way people run it with like, oh, as soon as it gets 50% profit, you take it out. I mean, it's nothing. And maybe if I was doing like bigger versions of that, I'd make a multiple on that, but we're not talking about life-changing money doing this strategy. And so I stopped doing it. I just took the money I was using to play in my cowboy account, and I just made some interesting stock purchases with that very small percent of my portfolio, and now I just left them alone.
You should the whole crypto channel on our Discord is going to just hop in here and say you should have bought iBit or something like that, man.
I do own iBit in my cowboy account. But I'm not in there like, man, I pop into that channel sometimes, and I am not throwing shade, guys, but
Bitcoin maximalists in there.
They are so interested in this. But I'm not like timing that market and selling and getting back in, and I just leave it. But anyway, Karsten's series does interest me, and you know, I'm not entirely sure why. I think it just seems like a cool potential source of income, but again, If I do start reading into it and I'm not super excited, I mean, I shouldn't do that. That's like really silly.
It's not
That's
a good a huge, use of your time. Yeah.
No, it's not. But it's it has appeal at some level, but I've done nothing about it.
Yeah. It's so funny to me that, and I think a lot of people in the FIRE movement, budget for expenses, but nobody budgets for time. I don't want to say nobody, but people don't think about budgeting for time in the same way. And, you know, I think about my parents, when I was growing up, you know, when I was living under their roof, they would drive way out of their way to six different grocery stores to, you know, to save 20 cents a pound on meat. And, you know, maybe that made sense. I wasn't up in their budget there, but I just don't get this kind of like spending of time for this sort of micro savings. And I do try and think about, and I think the business in some ways has forced me to do this, but try and think about, you know, what is the kind of wage that I want to be earning? And I don't get it right all the time. Like I still do customer service in my business. And that is something that I could, and everyone tells me like, you should be farming that out.
I'm one of them.
Yeah. If your time is worth, you know, more than $1,000 an hour or whatever you decide it is, I'm not saying that that's what my hourly wage is, but, you know, I think it's interesting to think about that with respect to being financially independent and what you are willing to trade your time for, because, you know, you're potentially missing out on a lot of life.
Well, and earnestly, you're one of the people, and reading Tim Ferriss helped too, but you know, you're one of the people who's really hammered home to me that that sort of calculus of what is your time worth. And you know, I think I was a lot better about that at work than I was about it in my personal life.
Yeah.
And I'm getting better, and retirement has forced me to think about it a lot more.
Yeah.
And talking about it so much with you.
Well, of course, and I mean, I've seen it with you too. I mean, just the fact that we haven't recorded that many episodes suggests that you're holding your time at a higher value than doing this. And I totally get it. And, you know, I think this is essentially a charity project that you and I are doing. We're not getting paid to do this.
Yeah.
And it's an example of a passion project that we're getting a lot out of. And could it make money in the future? Maybe. You know, I know a lot of people enter FI and they, you know, they start a YouTube channel or they're talking to other people about their journey and they end up making pretty decent money out of it. And I think a lot of people look on that and say, oh, well, that's like the vehicle that let them be financially independent. And I think that is true for some people.
It is true for some people.
Hey, Eric here with Two Sides of Phi. If you've been listening to Jason and I on the podcast, you may not be aware that we also have a YouTube channel. And quite often, we have supporting graphics, charts, information, and even a few outtakes that don't fit well in an audio format. So if you're into that kind of thing, you can find us on YouTube at Two Sides of Phi.
To give more numbers, right? I mean, this show is a couple hundred dollars a month, right? This is not It's well below life-changing money. It pays its expenses, and the time taken to do the work around it is at a loss.
I have to say, there are some other YouTube channels in our same space that are, you know, making a couple of $1,000 in advertising revenue a month, and I'm like scratching my head. I'm like, what are we doing wrong here?
Well, and you know, going back to, you know, how we want to spend our time, we're not chasing advertisers, and we're not doing big affiliate things, and you know, we've dipped our toes in some of that stuff, but neither of us are willing to spend the time to do that. And that's okay, because neither of us look at this channel as something we want to run as a business. And some YouTubers, that's literally what they've done. They've not retired, they've actually created a new business, and I don't judge that. The internet retirement police judge the hell out of that, and you know, so be it. But that's what we're looking to do.
I think it's interesting to think about this project and I know this is a little bit of a tangent, but you know, making connections with other people, this has allowed you and I to meet people we never would have met otherwise.
100%.
And make those connections. And as I get closer to retiring early and seeing some of my personal friendships here changing, even now, you know, people are like kind of backing away, like, oh, do we still need to be friends with them? They're getting ready to head off and go travel the world. And you know, I see a passion project or a side hustle or something as a means for networking and making different connections in the world, whatever that may look like. You know, if it's a winery job or if it's working in a brewery or a library or volunteering for some other cause, that's a means for filling the vacuum that work. You know, I see it for Laura. It's like work holds a big place in your life, and I've seen you go through this over the past couple of years, and now it's starting to kind of come into sharper focus for me as we're getting so close. I'm like, oh my God, this is a big deal. And so I could see, even absent making a lot of money, that this might work, especially for someone like Laura. She's like, yeah, this could be appealing to me.
That's right. Well, hey, if Laura wants to do like a fun science channel, you know, let me know. I still want to do that. I still want to do it. Maybe doing it with somebody else would make me do it. Anyway, I feel like we've hit the kind of fun passion project thing pretty hard. And it's a really cool one. So if your passion project happens to make money, that's great. And that's a really good reason, I think, to have some income coming in retirement. Now, one that I think is really, really common and that I don't think is a bad idea at all is people, after they've hit their FI number, making money in some fashion, whether it's doing the same thing or something else, as a security measure, like to de-risk. You know, everyone's worried about sequence of return risk. And, you know, there's probably a big gulf between like adding some safety and then putting like buffers on buffers on buffers, which I know you're a big fan of avoiding. We'll see what you do when you get there. But clearly, this is a reason that some people will continue to work, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, we know some people locally who are taking on little side projects, whether that's consulting. I mean, you know, in our space, the people that we're connected to, I know a lot of people retire and keep their LinkedIn profile active like you did and open themselves to consulting work, or maybe they want to join a board or something like that. Things like inflation can impact this too. You see all of a sudden you retired and now costs are rising 6-7%. You want to kind of backstop your portfolio a little bit. Market takes a drop. I totally get this. I guess for me, I would worry about this just in the sense that when is enough enough? Like when do you decide like, okay, we set this number and we've all been guilty of this. We talked about this before, but set this number, you get to the number and you're like, maybe the market is down. Maybe inflation is up, maybe some other factor. And you're like, I probably could use a little more. So how do you keep from just like continually adjusting up and up and continuing to work at some level, just filling all that time?
Yeah. You're right. And, you know, I think about this a lot because, you know, and I don't always comment on this on the Discord, but I'll dip in or dip into the YouTube comments and I'll see people who are pre-fi just hand wringing, about little tiny aspects of their number or small market moves. Or, and I, my concern comes from, not that they're spending time on it now, but I wonder what it will mean after they have hit their theoretical fine number. If that kind of behavior continues, you could see people kind of, you know, continuing to work and maybe not having any governance on that out of fear. And, you know, I get it. I mean, our brains are good at both being entirely irrational and rational. And when you have modeled certain inflation behavior or market growth, and you're seeing things on a micro scale that are well beyond that, well, it's a natural inclination. Like, well, I may as well do some work.
Mm-hmm.
But your point's fair. When is enough is enough? And at what point do you suddenly, like, look back and say, well, I actually ended up working a lot more than I wanted to, and in fact, more than I needed to.
Yeah, it's hard to set those clear financial goals and stick to the boundary that you set. I mean, Laura and I are discussing that right now.
So are you really? Tell me about that.
Well, just, you know, she and I are now meeting together with some of these people,
right,
and going to some of these meetings. And
For the business, sorry.
And, you know, when the question was asked at a meeting last week, like, okay, well, you know, what's the monthly revenue target? And I mean, that's a pretty interesting discussion to have, because yeah, theoretically it should be zero when you reach financial independence, right? I mean, we're going to hit our number. And so we're projecting for the next year forward. So what do you say? And, you know, I came up with a number that is, you know, I think realistic, but it's also like not really necessary if we go by the boundaries that we set. And so I don't have it solved, man, because it's just, I've said this before, it feels kind of silly to walk away from, it's almost like an annuity at this point, you know?
Right.
So what do you do with it?
And maybe this is the dovetail, right, Eric? Because you're also in a position of, I have a business, and I'm sure there's plenty of small business owners who follow the show, that at least many aspects of you love, right? If you were able to give away the tedium and, you know, the customer service and the things like that, and you really had just creative to focus some of your energy on, and I don't know what that means, and I want to talk about that, but you would love a lot of the remainder. And so how do you think about that and maybe turning it off at some point after you've achieved your fine number?
I mean, what Laura and I did was we looked at it from an hourly time investment per week. And we tried to work the number from that point. So we decided, you know, if we were collectively going to share 10 to 20 hours a week, like between the two of us, and work no more than that, is this a realistic, you know, number that we can still continue to do the things we need to do and have that come in, have that sort of revenue come in? And this is no different than just like buffering your portfolio. It's like adding buffers on buffers on buffers. But it could also mean, you know, we could do more giving. It could also mean we could help our folks out. It could all mean we could help our kids out, you know, generational wealth or whatever we decide. It just opens different doors and allows you to make different decisions. And I don't see it going on more than a couple of years.
Okay.
But I think, you know, we basically said, like, if this just becomes another job and fills all the space that we just created for ourselves, we don't want it, because what we've been doing in the past couple of weeks is really mapping out, like, pretty strictly what trips we're going to take. And we're both involved in that. And that's been really exciting to me, because
yeah, absolutely.
It means that the RE life starts taking up more space and kind of crap. And this is kind of how we operated the business. Like, you know, making more time for, as you said, the things that light you up and excite you, and making less space for the drudgery and the things that are less interesting.
It's commendable that you're actively talking about how can we make this work? because right. You do not want to trade away the benefits that you're supposed to get from doing the travel and having the time freedom for, well, we can eke more at it, not eke more. This, we can continue to get this business to produce at some capacity with hopefully a minimized amount of work for, it sounds like you're talking about, a few years. There's a scale there, because I know at least how your business, I know something about how your business operates now.
Yeah.
And you have these sprint periods.
Yep.
where, to steal a software development term, where you're very active and heavy for a period of days for a campaign or to finish, you know, some new property you're putting, you know, asset you're putting together.
Yeah.
And then, okay, things calm down again. And I do wonder, like, oh, well, would that fit when you're not traveling? Or what kind of care and minding will you have to do while you're traveling? Because, you know, I think even better than I do, because I like the way you talk about how travel and you interact. Mm-hmm. Anything that's going to pull you out of that headspace during travel, right? And I remember you talking about this on one of your trips. That's exactly the opposite of what you guys want.
No, it's very true. And I think, yeah, that's good for you to point that out. And I, part of the goal of having these monthly meetings with this group that I'm working with is to vision what the first question they said was like, what do you want life to look like this time next year?
Okay.
And like, that's a really good starting point for anybody, you know,
awesome question.
Just, if you
what does good look like? Right. I love that question.
That's right. And what are you doing now that you don't want to be doing? And so, you know, those things were, if I have to make assets, they have to be, I have to do those here. I'm not going to do those on the road. And so there may be a more intense period at the end of this year where I'm creating more of those things, and then we kind of release them over time. And
got it.
And that's what that would look like, because I very actively said, like, I am going to prioritize the life that Laura and I have outside of this studio together. And,
perfect.
You know, hopefully it means traveling with you guys and, you know, planning trips like that. I'm just so excited. I'm really energized by that, and mapping out the limited time we have in our 50s and the kind of activities we want to do, like, you just don't have that much time. So
that's right.
So yeah, I'm very aware of the trade-off there, especially with respect to time. You've navigated this now for a couple of years. So I've been able to see you get comfortable with your number and the ups and downs and being able to spend more. Like, you are spending more today than you did, and not just for an inflation adjustment.
Right.
So,
yeah, I am.
So how, because some of this need to kind of buffer your, you know, assets comes from this, you know, change in spending, this shift in mindset from saving to spending. And it's not easy. I can see. I know a couple of years ago, I was like, oh, it's going to be easy, I won't have any problem. But I can already see that's going to be a problem.
The closer you get, the more it becomes realistic. Like, but then, you know, I think it peaks and then you come down. I think very few people enter retirement seeming as cool and chill about it as somebody like Fritz Gilbert does. And I earnestly think he probably is that chill about it. But and maybe that's his financial background. But
big buffer.
Or earn, right? But for me, it wasn't. It was an adjustment. And I think some people have thought about this and they have a plan. They're like, well, sequence of return risk is the worst the first 5 years, so I'm going to be lower and then I'm going to go up. But even those people, they're still going to be spending at a lower level and then need to mentally shift. And I think some of them will struggle with it, but it's normal. It's where we get up in our head about stuff and we worry. That's why I think it's all part of this conversation I've had with so many, even traditional age retirees, that say, you know, 3 to 5, some of them have said 5 to 7 years to truly adjust to, like, this is life now. This is not like something I'm still getting into. It's like, spending. This is what it is.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of the things that I had in my list was, you know, this transition point can be a point to say, I'm going to step to a job that's less taxing, less demanding. And
exactly.
So it does make some money, but it's also helping me figure out how I turn into a spender rather than a saver. And it's kind of like training wheels a little bit for retirement.
That's right. Yeah. I think you wrapped it up well. Clearly you and I are going to continue to talk about this as you approach that milestone and as you move past it. You know, it's something we're going to want to continue coming back to, because it's essential.
Yeah.
Right. It's essential.
Well, and you pointed out too, not to derail what you were about to say, but
it's okay.
You pointed out too that, you know, things change. So changing priorities, I mean, that can be a reason to take on another job too, or continue something, you know, like, what if you want another house? What if you want a fifth wheel? What if you want a cabin? I don't know.
Something outside your budget.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to do something different.
Right.
It shouldn't be, I'm going to take on more risk. It should be, okay, there's another way to get there.
Yeah. Hey, Eric here with Two Sides of Fi, checking in with a quick request. Jason and I love making this show and sharing our conversations, but we need your help spreading the word. The best way to do that is to give us a quick rating and review on your podcast app of choice. And if you know someone on the Fi path, please hit that share button on your favorite episode. Every little bit helps. Thanks.
But and I think that fits with our next item, and that is increased giving, right? Many people have some aspect of giving in the FIRE community as part of their budget.
Yep.
But let's say you want to do something else. You want to leave a legacy to a family member, to a school or an organization you care about, or you want to, you know, relieve the debts of somebody else you know. It's hard to argue against that being a good reason to use some skills you have to earn some more money, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty good, because a lot of us have, you know, maybe we're giving something now regularly, but then our hope is at end of life, we'll have a bolus that we've allocated already, or we hope to allocate to a future need, but we'd like a little more certainty on that. And doing something now to ensure that, maybe setting up a donor advised fund or whatever you want to do, well, hard to argue that's not a good use of your ability to earn.
Yeah. And also, we talked about this before, but giving your time and being able to volunteer for things that you couldn't necessarily do when you were working full time. You know, it doesn't always have to be money, right?
Yeah, it does. And Lori really helped me think about that a lot, because before retirement, my idea of charitable giving was money.
Write a check.
Or assets.
Yep.
And, you know, now just this last weekend, we did a 3-day stint, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, at a spay and neuter clinic 2 hours away from us. And so they did cover our housing at the event, but the drive, our meals, our time, that's something we had to put forth. And, you know, it's up to all of us all the time to decide if that's worthwhile. But giving our time is something that we can do much more freely now. And at the present, it's our primary type of giving. We do still have some actual funds we give to organizations and family, but time is something we can spend a lot more freely right now, and you know, it feels good too. So something you've said before in the show, and I remember the first time you said it, and it was quite a while ago now, so I'm sure I couldn't find the episode where you said it, but this idea that for many people, earning money represents a kind of proxy for the value.
You're trying to get me in trouble, man. This is like one of my most controversial comments.
I think about this a lot, and I don't do it consciously. But this idea that if you're not earning, or let me flip it around to a positive, the magnitude of income you generate, whether it's for you or for a business you're a part of, right, that might not be yours, that sort of feels like the value you're contributing. And so I think for some people, they're like, if I'm not earning, I'm not contributing of myself. And I think that can be an unconscious thing, or it can be a conscious thing. And it is something you've said, and I do think there's truth to it. I'm not evaluating it pro or con, but I know for me, when Two Sides of Fi had months that earned more than now, and we did have months that were kind of twice as much or three times as much as they are now, those were spikes, it felt like, oh, we're doing more.
Yeah.
More people are valuing what we do. Obviously, they're watching it. And so the converse has got to also be true, right? Well, if it's less, I'm contributing less to the world. And, you know, that's a bit of a fallacy, but it's a real feeling you can have.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I guess when I made that statement, I really was thinking about it in terms of, you know, personal motivations. And criticize all you want. But for me, those project-based, you know, creating of assets, helping other people, creating impact, you know, that's all important. Those are important drivers for me for professional satisfaction. And
totally.
And I see myself searching for those similar project-based, you know, things in retirement. Do they have to contribute financially for them to still have that the same value to me? Probably not. I mean, I think, you know, I have some changing feelings on that. And Laura and I were talking about, you know, we've been following this YouTube channel, Brian and Carrie, who are, they're traveling the world full time. And I really love their style. There's just like very matter of fact, speaking to camera, they go to interesting places and they talk about their experience there. And I said to Laura, I was like, oh gosh, that would be like a fun project for us to do. Like, and she looks at that like, okay, well, that's just spending our time and and like then putting ourselves out there. And then there's like, we're going to have to document all this stuff. And do we have something different to say than they do? And so it fills me with excitement and possibility. And it's a project that I can dig into while I'm still traveling and documenting. That's all fun and exciting to me. And she sees work. So
yeah,
I could see impact there. I could see, you know, sharing that information has impact on she and I right now, because we're looking at traveling to some of those places saying, wow, I'm really glad they made that video. There's a lot of value there. Did I give them any money to make that video? No. Are they making money from it? Yeah, probably. They're probably making like a nominal amount of money. But it's not, that wouldn't be a driver for me making something like that. And I think the more that I get into this business, you know, I mean, I could be designing houses here on this island that are, you know, $10 to $15 million houses and making an incredible living doing that. Like a 10% fee on that kind of house.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
I could be doing that. And you know, I made a very specific decision to trade a portfolio of work here for one of impact and, you know, making videos and sharing my knowledge on architecture to people who don't have the same access to architectural education. It's like, that's a definite choice. And
yeah,
it's not the same financial trade as if I were designing a house for a, you know, a wealthy family that's going to spend $10 to $15 million on a, you know, a fourth or fifth home. Right. It's a different trade. And so like, it's not like I'm not already making those those decisions.
Yeah, for sure you are. I think it's, well, first of all, it's a really good thing that you and Laura are having that discussion about your different feelings on doing that. It's something I could see Laura and I doing too, because, you know, she was one of the people and a few other people in my life as well who questioned why, when I was on my Camino, was I documenting my day at the end of the day. And I thought of it first and foremost, it was for me. I was like, I'm going to get value out of taking time every day, looking at my photos and like thinking about my route and recording my feelings.
Yes.
And that was my primary motivation. And secondarily, I was like, well, if this benefits anybody else, that'll be cool.
Because you studied, you watched people, you followed people who did a similar thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, I did. And then I started to get the feedback right away on what I was putting out in the world. And it was like, oh, people are valuing this. That's really cool. Now, obviously, they were valuing the writing more than they were the videos on this channel, and that's why I stopped that experiment. And it was taking more of my time than I wanted it to. But, like, you know, Lori's question was valid, and it's like, is this somehow taking you out of your experience to write every night? Is there something you'd rather be doing instead? And I was like, well, no, because I'm doing it tends to be after dinner. I'm by myself. I'm just sitting down looking at my photos, or I'm on a break. I'm stopping. I've stopped walking for, you know, 15 minutes and I'm just jotting down what I thought about. They're just kind of rough notes. And I'm like, that didn't take me out of it at all. But for somebody else, it might. And so I think knowing yourself is really important. And especially if you start involving other people, like this idea of like when you're traveling, documenting it.
That's the thing, right?
You know, because I agree. It sounds like a cool idea to travel the world and kind of share those experiences. So many of us love that kind of YouTube experience, you know, kind of living vicariously through someone else's trip. And maybe it inspires you to do another trip, you know, of your own down the road. Like, but not everybody thinks of it that way. And and both are totally valid.
It's funny. Yeah. So would you say it enhanced your trip?
It did.
Okay.
It did.
Because that's how I feel about it, man. Like when I go take photos and I'm editing the photos, I can relive the trip and I can.
Me too.
I'm making something beautiful out of it. And it's like this curated little exhibit. You know, like my dad used to take slide film on every one of our trips, and then
his slideshows.
Yeah, he would curate these slideshows, and he'd like set them to music, and I mean, it was great fun. And a really engaging way. I mean, they used to have dinner parties; they'd have everyone over, and they'd show, you know, people slides of our trip. And I carried that forward, like when Laura and I were living in Connecticut, you know, and we would have friends over. We came back from our trips abroad, and like we'd do a little slideshow, and it, like people were like, "Wow, I've never I've never been to a slideshow before. And it was just like, for me, that's, there's some nostalgia there. And I know, yeah. But I know maybe Laura and Lori should just go off on their own trip and you and I can go document our stuff and meet up with our wives later.
Yeah.
You know, that is one of the things that I had on my list was skill development. You know, you can take on a job that you may not have had time to do otherwise, and you're developing skills and something that you hadn't had experience doing before. And that's a great trade for me.
For sure.
And I know you've kind of done that a little bit here and there. So
for sure. And several times I've undertaken a skill that I didn't like app development. I didn't do it because it would make money. I did it because I was interested. And if I liked it, yeah, it could make money. But, you know, I haven't yet developed something that I put a price tag on. They made a couple free apps and I moved on. Yeah, and I've done that with a few things. And it's money optional.
It's like right. In the skill bank. I mean, I made some physical products for the business that I thoroughly enjoyed. And they made very little money. Like the profit margin on a physical product is just so razor thin. But I learned so much from doing that. And I still got to do like all the graphic design and the packaging and, you know, shipping and creating a store online. And like, that's all fun to me. And it didn't generate a whole heck of a lot of money, but I still have those. That's in my skill bank. Like I have that.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll put it to use at some other point. So I like that. It's kind of skill building. And I think that speaks to this idea of, you know, once you reach financial independence, you start to make choices that just aren't based on money anymore.
Totally. I mean, Lori, to throw her back into this, I mean, she's got one of those little Cricut cutting tools with some of her fun money, and she's been making all these cut paper cards.
Nice.
And she's made some kind of swag for our homebrew club and a couple of gifts. And it's like, she's not doing it to me. She has no interest in setting up an Etsy store and making money. But if she decided to someday, she could, because she's doing this for fun and enjoying it and building skills and, you know, making mistakes and learning and improving. And it's like, but if it's ever only ever just that, so what?
Nice. Yeah. Does that thing work pretty well?
Because it works really well. Yeah. She makes shirts. Yeah, she makes shirts. She does cards and just stickers. She's having fun with it.
Wait, what do you mean shirts? She's cutting like vinyl or something?
So you're cutting, you can overlay different, you know, kind of printed materials and cut them and do
them. That's awesome.
She's made a whole bunch of t-shirts out of them.
She's making decoupage?
There's no decoupage. I do enjoy that though. I just got to. What kind of glue did they use for that? I just remember making, or some kind of shellac. What the hell is that stuff?
Yeah, it's some kind of paste made out of the horse's hooves or something.
Do people still do decoupage? Because I feel like that was a thing in the 70s for children. We just decoupaged things.
Dude, it's still here, man. There's a decoupage renaissance.
The renaissance of the decoupage. There you have it, man. So if decoupage is your thing, you could do it for hobby, skill building, fun. You could gift them to, retirement homes or whatever. I don't know. You could hit all the categories.
So are you going to continue doing the side hustle, Jay? Like, is it just going to knock off when you guys start traveling next year?
I mean, I have to imagine if we start traveling with any sort of serious duration, it's gonna. I can't see it not. And I'm okay with it. I'm not going to lament it. Yeah. If I didn't – when the last place I worked at decided to close their tasting room, if there weren't as obvious of a great next choice as their hat was when I picked up the new gig, I wouldn't have done it.
Well, maybe we can do kind of a beehive kind of co-working space. We can be traveling somewhere in Southeast Asia and – like for one, you know, afternoon every month, we just do the thing for my business, put it out there, and then we just gather up all the income and divvy it up.
There you go. I'll do your customer service during that time.
Okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's like, and this is one of the things Laura and I were talking about. Like, customer service happens like 24/7.
Yeah, believe me, I don't miss working in that part of my former industry. Everyone should work in customer service at some point. You learn a lot about how humans operate.
Yeah, man. All right. Well, it's been good catching up.
Likewise. I can't wait to hear more about your business plans as they develop.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. As we shut it down or sell it or what, who knows?
It's going to be fun. if you want to buy 30 by 40, email Eric at twosidesoffi.com.
$500 or best offer.
Oh, I'll buy it for that.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah. Heck yeah. I'll buy it for a multiple of that. All right.
All right, man.
All right. We'll catch up soon. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Join us as the conversation continues next time on Two Sides of Phi. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider rating it at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. For show notes, resources, and links to the video version, please check out our website at twosidesoffi.com.